You are listening to The Point from MC3 in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Check us out on the web at mc3church.org or find us on Facebook at mc3church. MC3, it's like nothing you'd expect. Good morning, MC3. As you've already heard, I am on vacation this day, Sunday. And because of that, we're going to do things a little bit differently with The Point today. We're going to make sort of a hybrid video, and I'll explain more about that later. But we're going to continue this census series. And to get into today's point, I want to show a clip to you from the movie The Fugitive. I believe the movie is from 92. It was a great movie, really popular back when I was young. We were in high school when this movie came out. But the plot of the movie, I'm not going to spoil things because there's a lot of spoilers that could be there. But the plot of the movie is about a guy named Dr. Richard Kimball. And he is a high-level surgeon, and he's accused of killing his wife. And he's convicted and sent to prison. And then through a series of circumstances, he ends up escaped, let's just say. And he has claimed the entire time, he has proclaimed his innocence through the entire thing. And so he is now fleeing from the U.S. Marshals who are trying to bring him back to prison. And so, again, that's why he's called the fugitive. And in this particular scene that we're going to look at, Richard Kimball is dressing, he's taking on the persona of a custodian at a hospital because he's trying to track down the real killer. And so in this particular scene, he's dressed as a custodian, he is a custodian, he gets a job as a custodian, I guess you could say. And he finds himself waiting in the ER just after a shift when things get a little bit crazy. So go ahead and watch this scene from The Fugitive.
Can I check the film on that kid? Al, what's the status on that kid? Al, get over here. Hey, can you give us a hand here? You bring this kid down to observation room 2? Yeah, you. Come on, help us out, okay?
Hey there, Chief. How are you feeling?
My chest hurts.
Yeah? Does it hurt when you breathe?
Yes.
What's your name?
Joel.
You just hang on, okay? You're gonna be okay, pal. You're gonna be just fine. Pull that elevator. Watch out. Thank you. Hey, Joel. How are you doing, kiddo?
Just.
Yeah? Where's your mom, pal?
Oh, no.
Is she home?
She's with my brother.
Your brother? Are they downstairs?
Oh.
Don't you worry. We'll get hold of her for you. What are you, a football player? Baseball player? Hold on, son. Okay. Hey, doctor. They sent this one from downstairs.
Bob, get this one into room 4, staff.
So there you go. We actually find out later on in the movie that he ends up saving that boy's life by changing the orders and sending him into surgery. And so in that scene, one of the things you noticed is that the ER doc, the first doctor there, he basically just relied on touch, did some physical checking of the ribs and things like that, and never actually took the time to look at the x-ray film. And the x-ray, of course, showed more than what he could tell by touch, by his sense of touch. And then, of course, it was only by looking at the x-ray film that Richard Kimball, the Dr. Kimball, could see that there was something bigger going on under the surface that required surgery. And so we're continuing this series on senses, and this is the third week, and we're looking at four of the five senses in this series, and we're going to be hitting all five of them during the new Sensations Fifth Sunday event for Prime Groups and Student Prime. But we're continuing, and with this idea of what that ER doc didn't do in terms of just relying on a sense of touch instead of looking at the x-ray, the same thing is true for us. So there are things in our lives that we just can't experience by touch. We can't rely on touch alone. And I use touch in quotes. I mean, I'm not talking about physically touching things, but also just recognizing what are we experiencing, what are we feeling, what are we going through. And if we rely on them alone, sometimes the real issue is under the surface and can actually cause damage. And so, while we don't have an x-ray into life, we do have a God who wants to lead and guide us through life. We only need to seek Him. And so that's the point for this week, that our sense of touch can deceive if we don't seek God. And since I'm on vacation today, as I mentioned earlier, we're going to do a bit of a hybrid video. And today's passage that we're going to look at as we continue with this series about touch, it comes from the life of Jacob in Genesis chapter 27. And it's a story that I taught a little bit over a year ago in the Deceiver series when we were looking at the life of Jacob. And so what we're going to do is we're going to watch a portion of that live stream video where I teach that actual story where Jacob deceived his dad, Isaac. And in this passage, Isaac, as you'll see or you'll remember, Isaac relied on his sense of touch instead of seeking God. And so the point that week for that video a year ago, it had a different emphasis than today, but the passage is the same. So as you watch, I'd like you to pay attention specifically to how Isaac relied on his sense of touch. So here's me teaching Genesis 27, 1 to 35 from the point in the Deceiver series. And by the way, I'm wearing running gear because that was my object lesson for that Sunday. So go ahead and watch this video, and then I'll be back to tie it back into the census series.
This is a story, as we continue the life of Jacob, it takes place later in his life. We're not sure. I mean, I guess we could kind of do the math and figure it out. But at this point, Isaac, his dad, is older. And actually, we'll see in a second, he's getting ready to die. He's pretty old. These guys are grown up now. Isaac and Jacob are grown men. And so that's kind of where this story takes place. So even in the Bible, in your Bible, this is Genesis 27. So if you have your paper Bibles there, you can turn to Genesis 27. We'll turn on the top row of lights there for you to follow that. Or you can go to YouVersion and work. I mean, don't swipe at all. It's Genesis right there at the top. And go to chapter 27. But it comes right after chapter 26 because that's where 27 comes when you count. And that's how that works. But it's 27, and it doesn't mean that it happens the next day. So there's some time has passed here. And we're going to see basically four little scenes. There are four episodes, mini episodes, or if this was a play or a musical, a Broadway show, this would be where the curtain would kind of come down, something would happen backstage, then the curtain would open again for the next scene. So we're looking at four scenes in this story of jumping the gun. And the first scene is Isaac and Esau prepare. Now, as a side note, we talked about this particular story in our B-side series, and you can find that on the slide at the beginning and afterwards. All right, it's already past the beginning is over. So afterwards, to listen to that, it was called The Deceiver that week. But we had the Isaac and Esau prepare. So here's the first scene, and I'm going to be reading this, a lot of reading here. I'm going to be reading this to you, and we'll just kind of have you follow along. I'll kind of walk through it a little bit. But it says in verse 1, one day when Isaac was old and turning blind, that's important, He called for Esau, his older son, or specifically his oldest son, which means, as part of that, and we said we talked about this already, but two things were a part of the oldest son. The oldest son got the birthright, which meant that they got the double portion of the inheritance. They got twice as much of the inheritance when dad died than everyone else. It meant that they were the one that was in charge of the family. They basically took the mantle of leadership of the family from dad when he died. And they were the decision maker. I mean, everything was tied into the birthright. And because of the oldest child, simply by birth, simply by being male firstborn in this culture. And as we talked about last week, Esau traded that up. But the second thing that the firstborn son received was the blessing. And the blessing was, it's kind of a spiritual thing. It's this idea of conveying God's promise to the next generation. And you'll see, actually, there's another story we're going to look at where Jacob gets blessed by someone else. But this idea of the blessing kind of says, okay, you know, not only do you have the physical things, but now you're going to have like the spiritual side of it. And I'll just leave it at that. There's a lot more of the complicated things. But in general, it means I'm going to have the firstborn. They're going to get the blessing. They're going to carry on the promises that God has made to our family. They're going to receive the God's presence with them, even though God is present with everyone. But that's kind of what the blessing was. And again, I don't have to get into too much more, but understand it's a big deal. But that's given specifically to the firstborn. So the birthright's already gone. Esau lost it. He traded it for a bowl of stew. So, context. So, he was turning blind. He called for Esau, his oldest son, and said, "My son." "Yes, father," Esau replied. "I am an old man now," Isaac said, "and I don't know when I may die. So take your bow and quiver full of arrows and go out into the open country to hunt some wild game for me. Prepare my favorite dish and bring it here for me to eat. And then I will pronounce the blessing that belongs to you, my firstborn son, before I die." And so this idea of the blessing goes to that. And there's an interesting phrase here. This says favorite dish, the NLT. The NIV says tasty food. I did try to do some research on like why. It's because this phrase keeps coming up over and over. I want to prepare some tasty foods. And tasty food, tasty food, tasty food. The word means gourmet delicacy. It means something that Isaac really likes. I don't know. There's something about it that was unique. And so this idea of my favorite dish, and you'll see that theme over and over and over as we read this passage. But there's something about it. It's kind of like it was dad's jam. Like that was the thing that he liked. And so if I was like, "Jack, my oldest son, I'm about to die. Prepare my favorite dish." He'll go, "All right, I'll get my Taco Bell gift card and I'll run down there right now." So that's kind of the idea here. And there's something about it. And maybe there's ceremony that's built into this. And we're going to have a special meal and then we're going to. Then he's going to provide the blessing. You know, sort of like we do special meals too. "Hey, we're going to have people over, and then we're going to announce we're pregnant," or something like that. And we're not pregnant. That would be like so many miracles of God would have to happen at this point. But that's what's going on. He says, "We're going to prepare this meal. It's going to be my favorite meal, and then I'm going to give you this spiritual blessing before I die." So that's the preparation. That's the setting of scene one. That's what's happening in scene one. But then you go from Isaac and Esau prepare to Rebecca and Jacob plot. Now, Rebecca is Isaac's wife. And again, we talked about that a little bit, but there's a really crazy story about how Isaac found his wife, Rebecca. And then Jacob is the second twin, and Jacob's name means deceiver. That's why the title of the series is that. So this is the younger son, Jacob, and mom, and Isaac's wife. And they start to plot. And here's the interesting thing, and here's where we're talking about this jumping the gun idea. So in verse 5, it says, "But Rebekah," so this whole story was happening, and Rebekah must have been in the other room in the tent, or wherever they were, in the yurt or the wigwam or whatever. "But Rebekah overheard what Isaac said to his son Esau." So over here, Rebecca is hearing that. Now, that's important because the very first week of this series, 2 weeks ago, we talked about this promise that God made. And just to refresh you, this is the promise God made in Genesis 25, verse 23. It says, "And the Lord told her," talking to Rebecca. This was before before Jacob and Esau were born. So they were in the womb, bouncing around, fighting. And before they were born, God said to Rebecca, "The sons in your womb will become two nations." And again, I'm not going to rehash the whole thing, but hey, this is a big deal. Your family's going to be huge. From the very beginning, they're going to be rivals. Of course they are. Brothers are like that. One nation will be stronger than the other. Of course they are. The oldest brother, of course, is going to be the stronger one because that's the way it works. The older brother is the one that has the birthright and the blessing. And then he says, "And your older son will serve your younger son." And so this was the promise that God made to Rebecca when she was like, "Why my boy's fighting in my belly?" And he's like, "Oh, let me tell you." And so this is that promise that God made. And so here she is in the other room hearing what Isaac was saying to Esau, going, wait a second. God said that the older was going to serve the younger. So that means that Jacob is the one that should be getting the blessing, because even though he's second born, God said that this is what's going to happen. And so Rebecca decides, well, if that was God's promise, I think I need to jump the gun here, because I need to help God out. I need to make this work, because God promised it, so it's my job to make it happen. And we could have paused the story there, and she could have been, she'd have gone out and just prayed to the Lord. God, you made this promise to me about Jacob. You made this, you said this was going to happen, and I trust that everything you say is going to happen is going to come true. And God, why does this seem? And maybe God would have answered and said, Rebecca, it's okay, I've got this. Don't worry, it's all under my control. But that's not what she did. It says, but Rebecca, next slide, overheard what Isaac said to his son Esau. So when Esau left to hunt for the wild game, she said to her son Jacob, listen, I overheard your father say to Esau, bring me some wild game and prepare me a delicious meal. There's that phrase again. Then I will bless you in the Lord's presence before I die. Now my son, she's talking to Jacob now. That's what she heard. Now my son Jacob, listen to me. Do exactly as I tell you. Go out to the flocks, meaning not go hunting, but go out to the flocks that we already have right here in house. Okay? Go out to the flocks and bring me 2 fine young goats. I'll use them to prepare your father's favorite dish. He must love goatness. So he says, then take the food to your father so he can eat it and bless you before he dies. So Rebecca's going, okay, wait a second. We need to change the plan here. And even at this point, it could be fair to be like, hey, maybe Dad will show you favor. Bring in his dish and say, Dad, I cooked it faster. You know, maybe you'll give me the blessing instead. But that's not what happened. So the story goes on and says, but look, Jacob replied to Rebekah, my brother Esau is a hairy man. I get it. And my skin is smooth. What if my father touches me? He'll see that I'm trying to trick him, and then he'll curse me, which is the Hebrew word here, curse, literally means the opposite of blessing. It's like, instead of giving me good things from God, he's going to pray that God kills me. He's going to pray awful things on me from God. So he'll curse me instead of blessing me. But his mother replied, then let the curse fall on me, my son. Just do what I tell you. Go out and get the goats for me. So I know that happens. You hear that phrase in your house sometimes too. Come on, kids, go out and get the goats for me. Actually, maybe you do if you're a farmer. You know, maybe you have to go out and get the goats. I don't know. But she's like, you know, I realize that we're being deceptive here, Jacob. And let me worry about that. And so it goes on. So Jacob went out and got the young goats for his mother. Rebecca took them. Now, look at the things that Rebecca did in this. She's saying, okay, I'm going to make this happen. I'm going to make this plan, this promise that God brought. I'm going to make it happen. Rebecca took them and prepared a delicious meal, just the way Isaac liked it. Then she took Esau's favorite clothes. So she went into Esau's closet, or his tent pole over on the corner, wherever he hung his robes and stuff. And she took his clothes, which were there in the house, and gave them to her younger son, Jacob. So she gave Esau Jacob's clothes. And I know that how that works. We had a dispute in our house. I'm not going to say who was disputing, but there was definitely a dispute over new deodorant. Deodorant we're disputing over. We're not even talking about their favorite clothes or things like that. And I know the favorite clothes are a big deal, but she went and got the favorite clothes and brought them and said, here, you wear Esau's favorite outfit. Then she covered his arms and the smooth part of his neck with the skin of the young goats. And so the goat skin was covered to make his arms feel hairy. Then she gave Jacob the delicious meal, including freshly baked bread, of course, because what good meal, you know, is really good if you add bread to it, because carbs are the way to go. Anyway, so that's the story here. So Rebecca's going, okay, God had this promise, made this promise. I remember that promise. It's been a long time. Remember, this is before they were even born. They were in the womb. And so, you know, what are we looking at? 60 years later? 80 years later? I don't know. But it's a long time. And Rebecca's going, well, God hasn't done it yet, but he promised, so it's my job to make it happen. And so now she's taking that step and bringing Jacob in on it. And you're like, oh, poor Jacob. Poor Jacob. Well, let's continue to read the story. So as Isaac and Esau prepare, then the second scene is Rebekah and Jacob plot. The third scene is Isaac and Jacob pretends. So the comma's there, right? So Isaac isn't pretending, but Jacob is pretending. And so it goes on in verse 18. It says, so Jacob took the food to his father. My father, he said, oh, I got to catch up on my notes here. I'm getting all excited. My father, he said, yes, my son, Isaac answered. Now let's stop there. Right up until this point, you know, mom said to wear the goats, and okay, I'll wear the goats. And mom gave me his clothes, so it's not really on me. It's mom made me do that. And then Isaac answered, who are you, Esau or Jacob? And I think it's important for us to recognize here that Jacob had multiple chances to come clean about this. So before we're like, oh, it's all Rebecca's fault, before we go all Adam, like, oh, God, it was the woman you gave me, she made me do this. Before we've got Adam and Eve, you know, that's the story. Okay. Anyway, he's like, no. Jacob was very involved in this. Because he says, Isaac answered, who are you, Esau or Jacob? Jacob replied, it's Esau, your firstborn son. I've done as you told me. Here's the wild game, which wasn't wild, because he pulled it out of his own flock. Now sit up and eat it so you can give me your blessing. I mean, it's kind of like, now shut up and give me your blessing. Eat this food. You know, because it's time. Like, I don't know if that was happening. But you'll see in a moment, time was kind of over the essence. But that's me just adding to the story. Isaac asked, how did you find it so quickly, my son? And like now, Jacob's getting into some like dangerous territory. He's like, well, the Lord your God put it in my path. Jacob replied. Like, oh, Jacob, you don't have to do that. You don't bring God into this. You're already cheating. You're already deceiving. You're already lying to your dad on his deathbed, or at least close to it. And now you're going to be like, bring God into this? Not cool, Jacob. So then it goes on and says, then Isaac said to Jacob, come closer so I can touch you and make sure you're really Esau. So obviously, Isaac's kind of skeptical here. He's like, I don't know, man. You sure? Well, we'll see in a second. He doesn't even sound like him. And so Jacob went closer to his father, and Isaac touched him. The voice is Jacob's. He's like, I recognize your voice. But the hands are Esau's. You're definitely hairy like Esau, Isaac said. But he did not recognize Jacob because Jacob's hands felt hairy just like Esau's. So Isaac prepared to bless Jacob. So he's getting ready. He's like, okay, I mean, you clearly are the firstborn son, and clearly you're the one. So let's bless you. But wait a second, though. Are you really my son, Esau? Like, another chance for Jacob to come clean. He asked, yes, I am, Jacob replied. And it has a feel there of Peter. When God said, you know, you're going to deny me three times. He's like, no, I won't. I'm never going to do that. And they're like, weren't you with him? No, I wasn't. I wasn't with Jesus. I don't even know the man. So, I don't know, maybe a rooster crowed somewhere in the world at that moment. But that's not tied to this story. But anyway, then he says, then Isaac said, now, my son, bring me the wild game. Let me eat it. And then I will give you my blessing. So Jacob took the food to his father, and Isaac ate it. He also drank the wine that Jacob served him. Then Isaac said to Jacob, and Isaac's still like, I don't know. Then Isaac said to Jacob, please come a little closer and kiss me, my son. He's like, because I know Jacob, Andy Stanley talked about this last week. I know Jacob's kind of a mama's boy. He kind of stays at home and does all the cooking and cleaning, maybe. But Esau, he's always out in the fields. He's always out hunting. And he's got a funk. Like, Esau stank. We know that about Esau. Like, hey, you're hairy. We love you. Thank you, brother. But, dude, you need to get into a fight with your brother over deodorant. Like, it is pretty rough. So he's like, I know what I'll do. I'll have Jacob kiss me, because when he gets close, everybody's going to know it right away. So Jacob went over and kissed him. And when Isaac caught the smell of his clothes, because they didn't have washing machines back then, he was finally convinced, and he blessed his son. So he's like, okay, all these opportunities for Jacob to come clean. And so Isaac blesses them. And this is the blessing. He says, ah, the smell of my son is like the smell of the outdoors, which the Lord has blessed. That's quite a... You're being too kind, Isaac. Like, you reek. You are really bad. I'm vomiting in my mouth right now because it's so bad. But hey, you love the outdoors, and God has blessed the outdoors. So we're going to take a positive spin on it. He says, from the dew of heaven and the richness of the earth, may God always give you abundant harvests of grain and bountiful new wine. May many nations become your servants, and may they bow down to you. Excuse me. May you be the master over your brothers. What? And may your mother's sons bow down to you. All who curse you will be cursed, and all who bless you will be blessed. And that last part is actually aligned to the promise that God made to Isaac's father, Abraham. That all the nations will be blessed. Those who bless you will be blessed. Those who curse you will be cursed. So the blessing is given, and basically Jacob is told by his dad, you know what? May your brothers and sisters, may you be the head of the family. May God provide for you in amazing ways. May you have a tremendous harvest. May all of these things go to you as I pass them on to you through God as the head of the household. And again, it's kind of a spiritual moment there. It's a unique thing. So Isaac and Esau prepare. Then Rebekah and Jacob plot. Then Isaac and Jacob pretend. And then you've got Isaac and Esau's pain in the fourth scene here. So as soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, and almost before Jacob had left his father, so see there's a little, like, whoop, he goes out of the door, the other guy comes in. Esau returned from his hunt. Esau prepared a delicious meal, there's that phrase again, and brought it to his father. He says, sit up, my father, and eat my wild game so that you can give me your blessing. But Isaac asked him, wait, who are you? Because remember, he was blind. You guys remember that from the very beginning? He was blind. Who are you? Esau replied, it's your son, your firstborn son, Esau. And it says, Isaac began to tremble uncontrollably. And that moment there, I don't know if Jacob was nearby or not, but like to watch your dad break down because you deceived him, like that just seems harsh. It seems rough. And he began to tremble uncontrollably and said, then who just served me wild game? I've already eaten and I blessed him just before you came. And yes, that blessing must stand. And again, there's a cultural piece to all this. Like, why can't he change it? Like, that's the way it went. That's how it was. Once that blessing was given, that's the way it worked. And so it says, when Esau heard his father's words, he let out a loud and bitter cry. Oh, my father, what about me? Bless me too, he begged. But Isaac said, your brother was here, and he tricked me. He has taken away your blessing. And this is the verse that is the focus verse for this passage. It says, Esau exclaimed, no wonder his name is Jacob, which means, Yaakov, means to deceive or to grasp someone's heel or to try to take their place. For now he has cheated me twice. First he took my rights as the firstborn, which you had a big part in, Esau. You traded it, okay, buddy? And now he has stolen my blessing. Oh, haven't you saved even one blessing for me? And so the deceiver lives up to his name. And so the story goes on and says, Isaac said to Esau, I have made Jacob your master, and I have declared that all his brothers will be his servants. I have guaranteed him an abundance of grain and wine. What is left for me to give you, my son? Esau pleaded, but do you only have one blessing? Oh, my father, please bless me too. Then Esau broke down and wept, crying, Isaac, dad, please, something. Finally, his father Isaac said to him, and this is it, like the blessing, this is a blessing, because he can't bless Esau with what he already blessed Jacob with. So he kind of comes up with some other pieces, and it's a blessing. It's not the best. He says, you're going to live away from the richness of this earth and away from the dew of the heaven above, meaning you're going to be in the desert. You're going to be in a dry area. You will live by your sword. You're always going to be fighting. And you will serve your brother. Like, thanks, Dad. Should have kept my mouth shut. But when you decide to break free, you will shake his yoke from your neck. So there's going to be a point where there's going to be a big fight. And you're going to be able to kind of kick him out. You're not going to be in charge, but you're going to be able to kind of separate from him. And we're going to talk more about that in the future weeks of this series. But that's the four scenes here of this jumping the gun. And all four scenes with Isaac and Esau prepare, Rebekah and Jacob plot, Isaac and Jacob pretends, Isaac and Esau's pain. And this whole thing was found upon Rebekah saying, well, God made this promise and he hasn't come through yet, so I guess it's my job to step in and make it happen. It's my job to do it. And of course, she lied, she cheated, she deceived. Jacob brought her son in on it. Jacob was all part of it as well. Cheated, deceived his dad, stole from his brother. And And we find out, and we're going to talk about this more next week, but Jacob ends up having to run for his life now because his brother was mad. And Jacob spends a long time wandering. He ends up getting tricked by family members the way he tricked other people. He never sees his mom again after this moment because he had to flee, and she dies while he's gone. And then you'll find out later, which we're not really going to talk about, but when you get into the story of the 12 sons of Jacob, also known as the 12 sons of Israel, they're cheaters too. And they're like, hey, we learned it from you, Dad. You know what we're going to do? We're going to sell one of our brothers into slavery and then coat his robe, rip it up, put blood on it, and pretend that he was killed. And so Jacob, like all these consequences because of their unwillingness to wait.
Okay, so there you go. Bringing this back to the census series, as I mentioned before we played that clip, I wanted you to look at Isaac and his sense of touch and how he used that. So let's look at that verse just one more time and highlighting what Isaac did in there. And so in verses 21 to 23, it says, "Then Isaac said to Jacob, 'Come closer so I can touch you and make sure that you really are Esau.' So Jacob went closer to his father, and Isaac touched him. 'The voice is Jacob, but the hands are Esau's,' Isaac said. But he did not recognize Jacob, because Jacob's hands felt hairy, just like Esau's. So Isaac prepared to bless Jacob." Now, I want to be clear. We don't want to ignore that God did have a bigger plan. And actually, the very first week of the Deceiver series, we talked about how God's plan flipped the script. It was opposite of what the culture was, because he said that the younger son was going to be served by the older, that the youngest son, Jacob, was going to be in charge. So God had a bigger plan in all of this, and I don't want to deny that. But on a personal level, imagine that all this pain that Isaac experienced and Esau experienced, and then even Jacob because of Esau's anger that Jacob experienced, imagine how much of that pain could have been avoided if Isaac had just asked God. And that's what I want to kind of bring that passage in and say, okay, if Isaac, instead of just relying on touch because he was blind, had said, "God, can you show me if this is Esau, if this truly is the son that is to be blessed?" But he didn't do that. He relied on his sense of touch and, of course, caused all sorts of pain. And so I wrote some things down here. You know, if he had just taken a quick pause and said, "God, can you show me? Is this the right son?" If that had happened, it would have prevented Isaac from using his last days of his life regretting. Remember, he was at the end of his life, so the rest of his life was probably filled with regret because he was in tears over what he had done and giving the blessing to Jacob instead. If he had taken a quick pause and asked God to show him, it would have prevented Esau from becoming enraged and causing a permanent generational rift in his family. Now, we know later in that series that Esau and Jacob reunited, but we know that it caused a generational thing. Even as we reflect back on the Stuck series, you remember that the Israelites wanted to pass through the land of the Edomites, and the Edomites were the descendants of Esau, and they said, "No, you cannot come through our land." And so the Israelites had to go the long way around to go to the promised land. So if Isaac had simply asked God, then there wouldn't be this generational rift between these two families. If Isaac had simply paused and asked God for direction, it would have allowed Jacob to live at home and not be fleeing for years on the run, fleeing for his life, fearing for his life because of Esau. And if Isaac had just asked, it would have allowed Jacob to have been there when his mom died, because as I said earlier in that video, that he wasn't even able to be there. Like, that was the last time he saw his mom. So again, God had a big purpose, and I'm not denying that because that was all part of God's plan. But again, on that personal level, what would have been different? Because we're watching this, we're seeing this story after the fact. And if after the fact, we know this was part of God's plan. But in our lives right now, we're living with now. Like, we don't see after the fact. We see now. And so there are things in front of us that we are, you know, we need to live to honor God. And I just wonder, are there situations, are there decisions, are there things that are happening in our lives right now that we're going to rely on our sense of touch, on our experience, and miss out on something that God has for us. Not that He wouldn't be able to give it to us, because He can. His plan is sovereign. But deal with hurt and pain through it. If we simply were to pause and say, God, is this what I should do? God, is this how I should do it? God, is this where I should go? And as I said, God can and does redeem broken situations. But what hurt would we have avoided if instead of relying on what we can experience, we trusted and asked God for direction? Instead of relying on what we can touch, what if we had asked God to show us the X-ray? So the point is, our sense of touch can deceive if we don't seek God. So if we're not supposed to rely on our senses, if we're not supposed to rely on what we can touch and experience around us, what does it look like to seek God? Again, what does it look like to look at the X-ray? How do we do that? Because if there's hurt to avoid, I think we want to avoid that. I think we want to go through life without pain as much as possible. And sometimes, and that's a whole other topic, but sometimes God does bring pain into our lives on purpose. But what does it look like to seek God? And so I'd like to suggest four things that we can do when it comes to seeking God. First of all, we need to seek God for what we need. And in Matthew chapter 6, verses 31 to 34, we see this what we need in play. And actually, a couple weeks ago, we talked about the difference between needs and wants, and how sometimes our needs are just things we really want. But here we're talking about the actual things that we need. And God, I have here, God will meet our needs. So instead of chasing after things and worrying, we should seek God and His kingdom and desires first. And that's what Matthew says in Matthew chapter 6. He says in verse 31, so don't worry. Actually, I'm sorry. This is what Matthew records Jesus saying. So don't worry about these things, saying, what will we eat? Or what will we drink? Or what will we wear? These things dominate the thoughts of unbelievers. But your heavenly Father already knows all your needs. He says, seek the kingdom of God above all else, and live righteously, and He will give you everything you need. So don't worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will bring its own worries. For today's trouble is enough for today. And so again, Jesus says, God's going to meet our needs. He's going to come through for us. But we try to go rely on touch. Okay, I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to make this happen. I'm going to take an extra job. I'm going to work these other things so that I can get what I want. I'm going to cheat this person or whatever it is. And we try to do these things and get our needs when God's like, I'm here to give them to you. I'm ready to give them to you. And so instead of worrying, we should just seek God. I have here, instead of trying to do to supply our needs, we should try to be and let God provide. And so often we're focused on doing and doing and doing. And Jesus says, look, just seek God. Seek His kingdom. And what He means by His kingdom is just all the things that are who God is, all the things that encapsulate His desires. Seek Him first. And then God's going to give you everything else. And the crazy thing about this is that when we seek God's kingdom, when we seek God's righteousness, to seek to be like God, to know God, not to be like God, but to be after God's heart, if you will. When we are seeking God, the crazy thing is that we start to see things the way God sees them. And when we see things the way God sees them, the things that we thought were needs now aren't that important. And we start seeing that God's needs and God's priorities for us are different. And so He even begins to change the way we pray. And so that's what Jesus is saying here is seek God first. Seek His kingdom. Seek Him for what you need. And He'll provide that. And in the process, instead of relying on what you have to do and fix, you're going to skip the worrying because you don't need to worry about today or tomorrow because tomorrow's got enough things to worry about. And He says, even the unbelievers worry about all that stuff. But He says, seek God's kingdom first, and He's going to provide everything you need. And again, as we looked at a couple weeks ago, He already knows what you need. And so when it comes to seeking God and saying, okay, God, what does it look like to meet, to have the things that I need? Seek God first and let Him deal with it, because He wants to give them to you. So maybe that's your situation, is that you need to stop trying to do and simply become. Try to be more like Jesus and watch Him provide for your needs. So that's one way that we can seek God. And again, a lot of times we try to do, we try to fix, we try to put our hands involved in it, and in the process go in a direction we shouldn't go, or in the process do something that we don't need to do, because God's already got something figured out for us. The second way we can seek God, not only for what we need, but also for where we go. And we're going to be looking at Proverbs chapter 3, verses 5 to 6. And we actually talked about Proverbs in the Wise Up series, and that's on the loop before and after. You can find it on our website. We're actually going to be doing Wise Up again this coming summer, so you'll get to hear more Proverbs taught this summer. But in Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, the writer of Proverbs writes, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and do not depend on your own understanding. Seek His will in all you do, and He will show you which path to take." And so this idea of saying, okay, God, I'm looking, I don't know what to do next. I don't know where to go. There's an opportunity here, should I take it? There's a situation, should I go into it? And we're like, what do we do? How do we, and we start going, okay, this is what I can see. That looks like it'll make more money. That looks like it won't. So probably make more money is better. And we go by practical things. And it's not always that. You know, this person seems to be nice to me and this person doesn't. So do we want to be happy or do we want to be miserable? And we let our feelings affect things. We use our sense of touch. And God, here the writer of Proverbs says, no, just ask God. He'll show you the x-ray. He says, if you're not sure what to do next, seek God. Make His priorities your priorities. And He will show you what path to take. And that's what this passage is all about. It's like when we seek God first, when we trust in God and the Lord with all of our heart, and don't lean on our own understanding, don't lean on our own sense of touch, trust Him and say, God, I want to understand what your priorities are. The writer says, He will show you what path to take. And He will give you the x-ray. And just for what it's worth, sometimes just that simple thing, and we'll talk in a moment about the quick moment, but sometimes that simple pause or that simple reflection to say, God, what are your priorities in this situation? Sometimes that is just enough to change it. Because sometimes there are decisions immediately that are not honoring to God. And the answer then is, you shouldn't do it. So God, okay, is sleeping with this person, is that honoring to you? Okay, no. There's no question, should I sleep with them or not? No. When we seek God's priorities, that is not what He wants for you. And maybe the job, yeah, maybe it is more money. But maybe it requires you to not be around for your family. Maybe it requires you to miss church every week and not be able to connect and worship with the body of Christ. Is that honoring to God? Is that God's priority? Because God's priority is for you to worship together and to be with your families. And so right away, the priority is clear. And so that's what the writer of Proverbs is saying. It's like, seek God in everything you do. And don't rely on your own understanding. Don't rely on your own sense of touch. Because when you seek Him first, He's going to show you. Because you're going to realize, oh wow, God, I now see this is what you want. And so again, it comes back to that not doing, but to the being side of things. Be someone that seeks God. Trust in the Lord with all of your heart. Don't rely on your own understanding. Seek His will in everything you do. Try to honor Him in everything, every little thing too. Not just the big things, but the little things. And then God's going to show you which way to go. And that's how we know. That's what seeking God looks like. That's what, you know, if Isaac had just said, God, is this the right thing? God would have clearly showed him. And again, that was the hurt that Isaac had to experience. And what hurt are we experiencing? Because we don't seek God. And we don't say, God, is this where I should go? Because in Proverbs, we're supposed to seek God first, and He's going to show us. He'll make it clear. He'll make it obvious where we should go. And so, seeking God looks like we seek God for what we need, for where we go. The next one I love is we seek God for when things arise. And this passage comes from Nehemiah chapter 2. And we looked at this back during the wall series, which again is also on that. But it was that whole series was about Nehemiah and the wall. And in Nehemiah chapter 2 is where we're going to be reading, but I want to give you a little bit of a setup. So in Nehemiah chapter 1, the context here, first of all, is that this is during the Babylonian exile, which we said a couple weeks ago, we talked about how Babylon brings. That was part of what they do to capture a nation, is they would bring them back to their home country. And we talked about that last week with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were in Babylonian captivity. Well, then, in time, the Persians actually took over the Babylonians. And so now the Persian Empire was the largest one. And the Persian Empire was allowing the Israelites to return to their land. They were in exile for 70 years as punishment for their disobedience, and that's what the whole King Me series was. But Persia permitted them, and that's what we taught in the series, was Babylon brings, Persia permits, was allowing some of the Israelites to go back to their land. And so Persia is now in charge. They're allowing people to return to the promised land, to the land of Israel. And in chapter 1, we find out that Nehemiah finds out, that the walls of his home city, of the capital of Israel, Jerusalem, that the walls are crumbled. And the gates are torn down. And so it's just, nobody is protected in the city. Raiders are coming in. There's all sorts of damage. It's just not a safe situation. And it really breaks his heart. And so he prays to God in chapter 1 and just basically says, God, your heart is broken too. Remember your promises to your people. And if there's any way that I could be a part of restoring the wall, rebuilding the wall, then please allow it to happen. And so that's the setup of chapter 1, which then brings us to chapter 2. And so, by the way, I should also say that at the end of chapter 1, the very last line explains that Nehemiah's job in the Persian kingdom is that he is the cupbearer to the king. And some say that that meant he had to taste things to make sure no one was poisoning the king. Some mean it was just sort of a servant. He was the one that served the food. But on some level, he has a direct access to the king. And that's kind of an important little note. So in chapter 2, verse 1, it says this: in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, who's the king of Persia, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before, so the king asked me, "Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." So he's sad, he's looking down, the king's like, "What's the deal here?" Nehemiah's usually pretty upbeat. This is a deep sorrow. There's something going on deep in his heart. And he continues on and says, "I was very much afraid, but I said to the king, 'May the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?'" And then he says, "The king said to me, 'What is it you want?'" And this is that really cool prayer, that really cool when things arise prayer, where Nehemiah says, "Then I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king." So I prayed to the God of heaven, and I answered the king. This isn't and I went away and said, "Hey, king, let me pray about it for a while. Can I get back to you in a couple of weeks?" This is in the moment. The king asked him a question. The king gave him, it was a big question. And in that moment, instead of just relying on, okay, maybe I can let the king know, he went right to God. "I prayed to the Lord and answered the king. God, help me in this moment. Give me wisdom right now." And then immediately spoke to the king. And it's such a cool thing here. Because it's so powerful, because Nehemiah shows us that we don't need to have, you know, grand, elaborate, flowery prayers. And there's time for that. There is, to be able to just honor God and just thank Him for all that He's done and just reflect on all that He's done. But sometimes there isn't time for that. Sometimes we just have a quick, desperate, in-the-moment kind of prayer. The "God, help me now" kind of prayer. And that's all we can do. But Nehemiah shows us we do it. If that's all you've got, don't be like, "Well, I can't pray officially. I can't get on my knees. I can't raise my hands," or whatever you think prayer needs to be. Nehemiah says, "No, I can be literally in a conversation with the king and going, 'God, please help me in this moment.'" And that is what it looks like to seek God. in the moment, to seek God when things arise, because sometimes we don't have the time to come back and say, hey, can I get back to you on this? And sometimes we do, and we should ask for that. There's nothing wrong with that, but sometimes we don't have that moment. And so when you're in the situation, instead of relying on touch in a panic, going, okay, what do I do? I don't know what to do now. Just ask God. And you can ask God in panic. Like, you could be like, God, this is a really difficult decision right now. Can you just please give me wisdom? And it, you know, it doesn't have to be out loud. It probably wasn't out loud for Nehemiah. But it was that moment where he prayed to God and reflected and asked God to give him wisdom in that moment. And I think that's such a beautiful way to look at this seeking God, is that sometimes there's moments where we just can't get away and say, God, I want to, can you give me guidance? But we can come to God in a moment and say, help me here. Give me guidance. Give me wisdom. And maybe your boss calls you in and says, I need an answer right now. I've got something I'm putting in front of you. Maybe there's a relationship situation. Maybe at school there's a moment where you're asked to do something and it could give you a chance to, I don't know, tell people about Jesus in a different way, but you're like, I don't know what to do. That's when you need those Nehemiah prayers. God, give me direction. God, show me the x-ray. Instead of relying on what you can experience, just ask Him for that direction. So that's what seeking God looks like. So seeking God is asking God for what we need, asking God for where we go, seeking God for when things arise, and then finally, seeking God for how to live. And this is from a passage in James, and we talked about James in the Dupe series, and that's also on the slideshow loop. But James gives us kind of the catch-all. So when it comes to seeking God, you know, there's all these things. Yes, we want to seek the kingdom of God first, and He's going to provide what we need. And we need to trust in the Lord with all of our heart, which is basically the same thing as seeking God first, above all else. And if we do that, God's going to show us the path to take. And even in the moments of crisis, of immediate, when if things arise, like I don't know what to do, ask God right there. And James gives us kind of the covering one that covers everything else of it. Everything else that's there. And in James chapter 1, verses 5 to 8, James says, if you need wisdom, ask our generous God, and He will give it to you. He will not rebuke you for asking. So first of all, James just says, if you need wisdom, ask God. He's a generous God. He wants to give you wisdom. If you need direction, if you need help, if you're in a crisis, you have a hard situation, if somebody comes to you for the blessing and you're feeling it's like, I don't know, you sure sound like the other guy. That's where we say, God, I need wisdom in this situation. And He says He's generous. And He's not going to say, why are you asking me for help? Like parents will do that maybe sometimes. Maybe coaches will do that. Like people we respect sometimes are like, you need to figure this out on yourself. And it's fine. That's fine for parenting and coaching. But that's not how God works. If you want wisdom, God, I need your direction. I want to honor you. He's not going to rebuke you. And then James continues and says, but when you ask Him, be sure that your faith is in God alone. Do not waver, for a person with divided loyalty is as unsettled as a wave of the sea that is blown and tossed by the wind. Such people should not expect to receive anything from the Lord. Their loyalty is divided between God and the world, and they are unstable in everything they do. And so James just kind of continues that thought by saying, yes, we can ask God, and He will not rebuke us. He's not going to say, why are you asking? He's going to give it to us. And he says, and remember and believe that God will. Believe that God will, because He wants to do that. He says, otherwise you're just being tossed by the wind. Like, God, I kind of hope you maybe give me wisdom. I don't know, whatever. James is like, don't do that. God's going to give you wisdom. Just ask. Instead of God, okay, God, this is a hard situation. I don't know. It sort of feels like this is the right way to go. This seems like the right thing to do. I don't know. I mean, my friend said it should be that way. Or I read on the internet that it should be, you know, TikTok video told me that this is definitely the situation. James says, don't be doing that. Don't be trying to feel it out. James says, ask God, and He will give it to you generously. Now, going back to Matthew and to Proverbs, you might ask, and God gives you wisdom, and it might not be what you want. It might not be what you think you need. It might not be a direction you thought you would go. But God will give you direction. And again, all these kind of come together And James is reminding us. He's like, look, the x-ray is right there. It's just like in that scene from the movie. It's right there. You just need to pick up the film and ask God. God, show me. God, give me wisdom. And so that's what seeking God looks like. We're seeking God for what we need, seeking God for where we go, seeking God for when things arise in the instant, and then again, seeking God for how to live, like for everything that we can do. Why do we need to do that? Because as we've learned from Isaac, our sense of touch can deceive if we don't seek God. We may be heading for hurt. We may be missing out on something that God wants for us, something that's God's best, and we're going to have to deal with the consequences for disobedience if we don't seek God first. Because our senses can deceive us. And our sense of touch can mess up because we experience the world in an inaccurate way because we're not going to God first. Would you pray with me? Father, thank you so much for the story of Isaac and of course the big picture that we learned a year ago with that series. But even today, realizing that our sense of touch, like we are human, we're frail, we're flawed, and our experiences are not always accurate. And so I pray that in those moments and in all of our moments, that we would seek you first, that we would go to you and ask you for insight, to ask you for the direction that we need, that we would go to you and instead of trying to just do a physical exam and using our sense of touch and experience, that we would go and say, God, give us the x-ray, show us what is really going on beneath the surface. And I thank you that you provide that, as James said, that you are generous in giving us wisdom. And I thank you that Nehemiah shows us that we can pray in an instant. God, I pray that you would help us remember that in the moments where we're like not sure what to do, that we don't forget, we can go to you right then and ask you for wisdom, for guidance. And then as we saw from Jesus and in the Proverbs, God, help us to seek you with all of our heart. Help us to seek your kingdom, to want you the most and to become like Jesus. And when that happens, you will show us the path to take and you will give us what we need. And sometimes the things we think we need will change because you open our eyes to your perspective. So thank you so much for that. Thank you so much for your willingness, your generosity, and being willing to give us direction, being willing to give us guidance in everything we do in life. So we thank you so much. In Jesus' name, amen.